Hello, I'm Brian.
And I'm Claire.
And this is the Computer Weekly
Downtime Upload
Podcast.
Welcome to the podcast. That third voice, welcome, Cliff, was our colleague, Cliff Sarin. Great to have you back on the podcast, Cliff. Welcome back.
It's good to be here.
Yeah.
It's been a while.
Yeah, it has. A lot has been going on.
I think last time was quite early into lockdown, and you talked about Bob, your pufferfish.
We were talking about Bob a few seconds ago. Yeah, Bob's grown.
Has he?
Just a little bit. Grown in appetite, definitely, over in terms of inches. He's about the same length, but he's far more voracious now, and will eat pretty much anything that drops into the tank.
Blimey. And also, you're talking about cooking on that one as well.
Not cooking, yeah. Bob.
Not cooking Bob, no. But also, Cliff, you were talking about the likely shape of enterprise IT after the pandemic.
Wow, we're still doing that today.
Yeah, and we'll link to that in the article that goes with this podcast. It'll be interesting, I think, when we do get properly post-pandemic to see how the new reality, you know, matches up to what people were speculating about two years ago. Yeah, but it's great to have you back in the pod. We do talk about you, Cliff, quite a lot on the podcast. You do come up.
Behind my back, as usual.
That's all good stuff. All good stuff.
Certainly publicly available to everyone.
Yeah, like your, I'm just thinking your IT sustainability type pieces. I know Claire talked about at least one of those on the first of our COP26 episodes last year. So though you've not been here, you've been a presence, even in your absence. Guys, just to say where we're going in the episode, for the benefit of the listeners. So Cliff, you're gonna fill us in on the metaverse.
Am I? Yes, of course. Yeah.
Well, I do hope so.
I will definitely be filling you in on this.
Excellent. And Claire, it's the Makers Women in Software Power List that you're going to be talking about.
Yeah. So women in tech, one of my favorite subjects. It's the fourth year of the Makers Women in Software Awards, including the Women in Software Power List and the Changemakers List as well. So I'll tell you all about that.
Yeah. More on that in a wee bit. I'm going to talk about my visit to Unipart this week. And that was to interview their CEO, a gentleman called Yanis Levantis. They're a big SAP customer, Unipart. They're a very, very big local employer in my adopted hometown of Oxford. More on that towards the end of the episode. What I found out from Yanis Levantis, and I'll tell you a bit, fill you in later on that. Claire, can I invite you to get the ball rolling with Cliff on the subject of the metaverse?
You can, because I don't understand it. So some help understanding it would actually be very helpful. I don't know what it is. I don't know why people are so enamored with it. I don't understand, Cliff. Help. So what exactly is the metaverse, and why is it important to us? Why should we be talking about it?
I'm trying to figure that out myself, actually, to tell you the truth. But do you remember, maybe you're all too young, but there used to be a thing called Second Life.
I'm not too young.
Yes, yeah, I remember that.
And I remember trying to understand what was the point of Second Life and having avatars. And this was like maybe 15 years ago, 20 years ago, I can't remember exactly, but it was a heck of a long time ago. And I've been to a couple of briefings in the metaverse very recently, in the last week or two, and nothing much has changed, honestly. So the commercial, the enterprise, the business side of the metaverse seems exactly the same. It's a virtual world where these sort of block-like characters, Mindstorm-like, you know, sort of walk around and talk to each other. Is that the future of the internet? I don't know. But there's a lot going on there. Businesses don't want to be left out. So even though they don't really understand the metaverse, they don't want to be in the position where, say, the clicks and mortar retail businesses were when the internet came along. Who would have thought Amazon? They just sell books and records. What? You know, it won't make any difference to us. Well, hold on a second. You know, it started a revolution, right? And I think the metaverse has the potential to do that. What we've seen online gaming. What we've seen with online gaming is that people do play in virtual worlds, right? They do enjoy being immersed in virtual worlds. I don't have the figure to hand, but I'm sure I read somewhere that this was the biggest year for the Oculus headset. I don't know if you've ever tried one, but they are pretty awesome. It's like having a massive TV screen in front of your eyes when you put it on. You know, Facebook's doing a lot with Oculus to make it the place for the metaverse. In fact, so much so that Facebook is now called Meta. The good news is that I don't think Facebook is going to be the only company in the metaverse. Phew, you know, there'll be one of many, many, and there won't be one metaverse standard. There'll be lots of little metaverses that need to talk to each other. Otherwise, what's the point?
Yeah, so you don't think that we're moving towards like a Ready Player One scenario where day-to-day life takes place in the metaverse and we're all living virtually, going to school virtually, going to our jobs virtually, leaving the physical world behind in a way?
To use a cliche, it's an alternative reality. And I think that what we'll see will be inspired by the game developers and the computer programmers who watched Blade Runner and all those movies that are based in VR land and, you know, augmented reality. And I think it's what we've seen so far, and some of the research shows, is that people who play games are going to be the early adopters because they're already used to it. And as I said earlier, they live their lives in that space. And it raises an interesting question, which is, what happens to things that you buy in the digital world? And I was scratching my head over this because we do own digital assets, or at least stuff that is digital, right? You know, even though it's a physical product. So stuff like, I mean, even a vinyl record, although it's, you know, it's analog, it's actually a media. A CD is obviously media, DVDs are media. But now we increasingly use streaming services like Netflix, Spotify, but when you buy something, I mean, I don't know if you've ever bought movies off Prime or whatever, and their digital downloads. You know, you're not owning a physical product. You own something that's purely digital. And in the metaverse, they're talking about owning, you know, digital artwork. And this is what I think has been happening in the games industry. I used to, years ago, I used to take the train up to London with this guy who was a games developer based near Piccadilly Circus. And he kept telling me that his role in life, the games were free. It was an Android platform thing. The games were free, but they made money out of little applets within the game that people had to buy. And I couldn't see at the time how that would work, and little things. So, you know, people buy bits of code, a few pixels and a few sounds, and it's of intrinsic value to them. I didn't understand, appreciate why that would be such a compelling thing, but it is in the gaming industry.
Yeah, it definitely is. You don't game then?
Not on those. My games are playing with my nephew because I live in Brighton, in the Brighton Marina, and what we were doing over the weekend was playing Pac-Man.
Pac-Man.
Circa 1978 or whatever, like, version.
But then imagine if you could buy different outfits for Pac-Man, or imagine if you could buy like different ghost avatars and you could like make them the faces of your enemies to chase around instead. That's where they get the upsell, right? It appeals to you on sort of like a different level. It's something that makes the experience better. You're willing to pay a little bit of money for that, I guess. The same for, you know, like dressing up avatars and stuff like that. You want to have, you know, like the outfits.
Exactly. I mean, I did a blog about this, and I was looking at, well, you know, the whole idea. I mean, this is big picture, right? You know, capitalism, and companies have to make money, right? And they have to sell more to consumers. If you look at every company report, it's all about growth, right? And the problem with that is that, you know, today's, what, Earth Day, right? You know, there is only so much on the planet, there's only so much you can do. We can't consume everything, and certainly there must be an alternative way of doing these things and making money. Now, digital assets don't use as much resources as real assets. So, Claire, your digital makeover, your avatar, is going to cost a lot less than smart clothes and whatever in the real world. You know, this is, and then as you say, you know, just like the Pac-Man being, you know, whatever, it could be a good thing for a generation of people who live in that world, in, or are big on social media, and they want to dress up their avatars. And they all, imagine, Brian, that you could own a Ferrari and a helicopter, not in the real world, because we can't, right? Not on our salaries as poor journalists, but, you know, that in a virtual world you can, right? And maybe it's going to cost you a little bit more than, you know, owning a Honda Civic, for the sake of argument. wouldn't you do so? Nothing wrong with Honda Civics, right? But you know, if it was only a little bit more, you could say, well, I could live this lifestyle for a bit in the virtual world, and it wouldn't cost anything, and it wouldn't cost the planet anything.
Yeah, and I guess if you pair that with things like the Oculus that you mentioned earlier, you could experience it more or less for real, even though you weren't really going anywhere.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, I once went to the I had the privilege of going to the Aston Martin factory years and years ago. And this was before these days, you know, computer games use real schematics from cars, you know, the CAD-CAM stuff. And they were talking about, you know, licensing particular models to the car companies, to the games companies, sorry. And one can see that as an opportunity in the metaverse, where, you know, you could get the latest, greatest, you know, build up your specification for your latest car, you know, your Aston Martin or whatever it is, and drive it in the virtual world. And maybe there's a link to physical product as well. I mean, where you could try things on, you could drive things, you could whatever, and say, well, actually, I like this so much, I want to buy something for real. So Brian, yeah, don't. Maybe it's not such a good idea buying the virtual Ferrari, because you will be at the Ferrari showroom the next week, you know, putting in an order.
I'd probably just crash it
in the virtual world, and that would be real life financial damage, because you've crashed your virtual Ferrari, right? You need to pay for the repairs.
Yeah, I was getting quite into the vision that Cliff was spellbindingly talking about there until a couple of seconds ago, and I realized there could be that, yeah, damage, actual damage. And towards the end of that blog post, Cliff, which is the leader in the, I think it's the leader in the issue, isn't it? You talk about, wouldn't it be great to kind of liberate ourselves from physical things.
I mean, the blog came about because traditionally Easter Sunday is the day when retail closes. You know, there are shops open, but the big stores are supposed to be closed. And if you speak to retail IT managers, that's the day they do the big rollouts. They deploy their major software. These days, e-commerce means that the shops never close. Online is, you know, always happening. And of course, we're inundated with advertising about buying stuff, real stuff. You know, Claire, how many sofas do you own? You know, it's Brian, you know, how many TVs do you need? I don't know, right? You know, there is a certain number you might need, one, two, I don't know. But certainly,
yeah, there is a limit.
Amount of advertising that's out there would suggest. So, and it got me thinking about, well, maybe a way to satisfy consumers' need to buy things is for them to have this in the virtual space. You buy a virtual penthouse, for the sake of argument, and then you kit it out with, you wouldn't actually, but imagine kidding it out with all these sales furnitures. I don't want to say DFS, but I'll just have or heavy tat or whatever, you know. And
that's fine. There are alternatives.
I was thinking of a quote from what's the film Total Recall. I'm thinking of the Arnie Schwarzenegger version, you know, not the other one, not the new version. But, you know, it's about what never changes about you when you go on holiday? You never change. And maybe the metaverse is that thing where you can be the person that you've always wanted to be, or be a superhero, or, you know, all of that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
Separate you a little bit from reality. And you know, that's got to be a good thing.
And weren't they saying that about Second Life? It would give you that opportunity. But I guess the technology must have moved on very considerably since then.
I think it's not the technology. The technology has always been there. I think it's just the understanding of what is possible. What would people accept?
And I guess also social media and the ubiquity of social media has completely transformed things. I mean, we all dabble in that, but some people are really hugely into their socials, and you can imagine the metaverse, you know, being very relevant there.
Yeah, social media, I think, is, or social media users are going to be the second biggest demographic.
Second biggest, yeah.
After the games people.
Because there was a Forrester report, wasn't there, Cliff, that you wrote about, the state of the metaverse? Mm. And I think they spoke about that.
Yes, that's where the figures come from. I mean, they looked at whether the metaverse is something that's going to be, you know, real today, and no, it isn't.
No, it isn't.
Within 5 years, we should really be, we'll be talking about it. But there's other things to think about in the metaverse. It's like, you know, one could see it. We've written about digital twins.
Yeah.
So having a in the metaverse, but not for a person, but for a piece of equipment.
Yeah.
It then makes a lot of sense, because that digital twin is a simulation that looks like the real thing, and it's running in virtual reality, and the engineers can go in and have a look and see what's going on more naturally than having, if you know, it's a big piece of machinery like a wind farm or something offshore.
Yeah,
you don't want to have to take a boat out to go and see it.
We were speaking about that on the last episode, actually, about wind turbines, and yeah, that would be a use case. So cool. Well, I mean, the metaverse is not with us yet, but it does have quite kind of big implications. CIOs, etc., probably do need to think about it quite a bit. Another thing CIOs think about is in the real world, the basics of Windows. And Cliff, you've written a couple of things. One thing in particular about Windows 11.
Oh yeah, Windows. Gosh, I don't know what Microsoft and the whole PC industry is up to tell you the truth. well, I do know. I mean, it is it's Earth Day, right? And we are thinking about the need to not buy things all the time. And why should you need to buy a new PC to run a new operating system? An operating system is only a piece of software that makes use of the hardware. That's all it does, right? It powers the hardware. It lets lets you do things that you can't do. Windows 11, it has a minimum spec. I've got a PC that's quite powerful, but it's an older processor, not compatible with Windows 11, not in its, you know, basic form. You can hack it, you can tweak it, and yeah, you know, make it work, and it will run Windows 11 fine. But that's a level of complexity that I don't think people will want to do, not in the home. And in businesses, it's a bit like you would definitely not want to hack around with the registry to get it to pretend to be a legitimate, you know, PC processor. So Intel, Microsoft and the rest of the PC industry really want you to upgrade to the latest hardware. And the latest hardware, I mean, you're going to get, you know, they're nice pieces of hardware, but there's nothing wrong with the old hardware. Why should you have to upgrade? And you can't. You know, it just should not happen. Not when PCs are so powerful at the moment. There's nothing you can't do apart from play, you know, the super duper games, right, which need graphics processors anyway, on, you know, a 5-year-old, 4-year-old piece of, you know, PC equipment, laptop, the desktop. You know, you run out of storage. We're using SaaS at the moment, aren't we? I mean, software as a service, right? Everything is cloud-based. So you're using less of your hard disk or less of your SSD drive. The amount of memory you use is, you know, you've got stack loads anyway. You're unlikely to use tons and tons more unless you're a power user using, you know, things like CAD/CAM or things like that. You know, you're doing number crunching on your PC. But, you know, there's so many alternatives. And so I think as a piece of hardware, I mean, it's not just PCs, it's Macs as well, but we're talking about Windows 11. as a piece of hardware, they do, they should not need upgrading. They should be like the set-top box that you use for you to watch to stream TV services. I mean, I've got an old Roku box and it still works. I mean, I don't know how old it is, probably 10 years, and it still does a job. But I watch, you know, I can watch Netflix and Prime on it. I'm paying for the services. I'm not paying for the little box that that lets me access it. And I think the PC should be like that.
That sounds sensible.
But it's a very modern thing, isn't it? Having like failure built into stuff so that you have to replace it after a certain amount of time, which isn't something that people really thought about when certain technologies were first introduced.
Yes, I've got a lot to say about this, but I'll be very brief. I mean, true story. I mean, yesterday I've got solar panels on in the house, on the roof of the house, and it feeds into a solar diverter, which is a little box that converts the electricity. Well, it basically runs an immersion heater in my hot water tank. So I get free hot water in the summertime when the sun shines, which is nice, you know. It means I get zero gas bill in the summer. All summer.
That's amazing.
The sun's been shining for the last 3 weeks. Mm. I have that switch on the heating because the hot water tank's hot. It just remains hot. Anyway, this unit is 6 years old. It's embedded into the house. It's a piece of technology, smart technology. It's embedded in the house. Yesterday, it packed in permanently, broke, you know. And then you've got to call out the heating engineer to take it off the wall, rewire the immersion heater to make it work again. You think, well, why does a piece of smart technology that's built in, why has it only lasted that amount of time?
You're like, what broke about it?
I don't know. Printed circuit board, I don't know, you know. But this is the problem, you know. If we're going to use stuff and... The PC industry hasn't learned, but I think the smart home industry is going down the same route, you know, where you can't see these people. You'll be in a position where people are having to spend tons and tons of money because this stuff's not cheap. And then every 5 years, have it replaced and have an engineer out to replace it. And that's not cheap either. So it's not sustainable. And I mean, yes, the PC industry has been doing this all along, and maybe all these other sectors are looking into, well, we can make money the same way by building an obsolescence. But your hot water boiler, your central heating boiler doesn't have built-in obsolescence. It's built to last. It will break down because it's got wear and tear. It's got moving parts, you know, it's got burners and stuff. It will break down, but it's a long time, and one expects it to break down after a certain period of time.
Mm. It depends, I guess, what the product is and what's wrong with it. There's like, if you can develop software to run on old hardware, it just shouldn't be an issue. It should scale. Like, it should scale depending on the hardware that you've got.
There is a piece of software. It's called Linux, and Linux will run on pretty much, you know, from anything from a Raspberry Pi right up to a supercomputer, and it does. You know, it runs everywhere. And the problem with, you know, Windows 11 is that the whole PC industry relies on a new Windows operating system to generate revenue, and that model has to be broken. You know, I'm sorry, it's not the right way for them to sell PCs.
No, I think that's very convincing.
What alternative do you offer, Cliff?
Yes.
scrap it all.
What's the answer?
Well, there's going to be niches, and maybe the PCs need to be much, much more expensive than they are, and have very basic models, really low cost, so that people like, well, I think there is a report I've seen where they're talking about, it was the Forrester report, actually. So the people using the gaming machines, the high-end PCs, I mean, if you're going to go into the metaverse, we were talking about the metaverse, if you're going to go into the metaverse, a machine might cost $5,000, you know, thousands of pounds, right? Yeah. Because it's got high-end graphics cards, it's got everything you need. It's, you know, huge tower, water-cooled, whatever it is, to be in the metaverse and to play the games in real time in the metaverse. But, you know, to do your day-to-day Facebook stuff or whatever, social media, watch YouTube, you know, you just need a basic machine. As I mentioned, my Roku does most of that. It doesn't do Facebook, of course, but certainly it can stream YouTube quite easily and all of that. And look at the, you know, the Fire TV sticks. That's a tiny gadget, but it's really powerful given what you're able to access from it. I don't know what the answer is, but, you know, possibly it's PC as a service where, you know, the likes of Dell and HP are able, and all Lenovo are able to sell devices through a subscription model that you pay over many years, and and they take it away. I mean, this, it's Earth Day, right? Going back to the fact that it's Earth Day, the fact that this thing that you buy that can't run Windows 11 anymore needs to be replaced, that means all the components in there need to be recycled. And, you know, there's, I read somewhere about there's tons and tons of gold in the PCBs and the electronics and the, yeah, and the chips. This huge amount, you know, a mountain of this stuff. This stuff needs to be recycled. There's rare metals in PCs that need to be recycled. And laptops have lithium batteries, right? You know, there's a whole load of stuff in there that needs to, we need to figure out a way of sorting that out. And maybe that's what the PC industry needs to be focused on, rather than the selling the one side of it. They need to be focused on the whole life cycle and how long that machine will last, and then what happens to it as it moves from a useful PC to somewhere else.
Mm. And it's not just PCs either, it's phones as well, isn't it?
Mm.
And yeah, iPads and or tablet devices.
I'm guilty of this, you know, because I tend to have one of the latest phones, but yeah, it is a hard one, and I don't know how we get out of it. The problem with the phones is that the battery doesn't last very long.
Yeah.
But why does the battery not last long?
Because you charge it 100%, you're not supposed to.
Are you not?
No.
Well, there's a top tip from Cliff. I didn't know that. I'm always charging my phone up to the max.
Yeah.
I let it run all the way down and then charge it all the way up and then run it all the way down.
Yeah, effectively.
Is that bad?
I do too.
Well, no, running it all the way down, I mean, it should have a buffer. It should go to, like, you know, 10-20%.
Yeah.
And although it says zero, it's actually got 20% in there. And similarly, at 100%, it's actually really only 80% full. But I don't know. I mean, I don't know if Apple and Samsung and the others actually do that.
I mean, there should be this kind of shift to where stuff's a lot more dematerialized, and it's about software and it's about services and not about the devices and so on. But, you know, there are companies that clearly have an interest in, you know, buying more kit that they've been successfully selling for years and years and years.
But there is an alternative market. I mean, you look at the right to repair. The, you know, if you were to pick all the components in the PC from a, and buy them, it would be more expensive than the whole PC, right? So if the likes of Dell and HP and whatever, whoever, yeah, sold the parts to repair the PC and to keep it up and running and took all the parts back, like HP does with its inkjet, has a recycling,
cartridges, has a
recycling thing with that, then, you know, it's that sort of creates like a nice kind of closes the loop, so that yes, your PC can be upgraded to the latest and greatest, and maybe it'll be able to run Windows 11. But at least the components, you know, you're able to keep the hardware, keep the shell of the machine, keep the motherboard, keep the bits and pieces that are breaking, and just replace the bits that are not. And they'll be able to charge an engineer to go and fix it for you. And, you know, this is in the enterprise. In the consumer space, you presumably just ship it back and something else comes along in the post a few days later.
Thank you for all of that, Cliff. It was a brilliant tour de force, taking us from the metaverse, speculative futures, and all the way back down to phones and PCs and stuff. So that's fantastic. Thanks so much for that, Cliff. So, Claire, shifting gears, and just forget about the metaverse for a little bit and back to the world as it really is now. And so you're saying, well, can I get involved in, and we've been involved in the past, in the makers, you know, the Power List, Women in Software. Tell us where, I know you want to make a bit of a call to action as well about nominees.
Yeah. So the Makers is a software bootcamp. So people who want to be software developers can go join Makers. They teach you in a certain amount of time how to, you know, like be a software developer. And they have quite a high, They have quite a high proportion of women that take part in their bootcamps, and they partner with quite a lot of organizations as well that then hire the people that have trained through the Makers bootcamps. This is the fourth year of the Women in Software Power List and the third year of the Changemakers List, which are the two categories within the Women in Software Awards, which is run by Makers. So for the Women in Software Power List, the organization is looking to highlight 20 women who have been in the software development sector for 6 years or less and hold them up as role models for their contribution to the software industry and all of the progress that they've made in that time and all of their achievements within, you know, like their beginnings as software developers. And I know that we've spoken before about the fact that the number of women in the tech sector has been stagnant for a number of years now, and the role models can make a huge difference when it comes to encouraging people from underrepresented groups into the sector. I know that the quote, "You can't be what you can't see," has definitely been said by President of Tech UK, Jacqueline Darroca, before. And I think it's true. You know, I think in some instances, if you can see other people, not necessarily people who you want to be exactly like, but people who are achieving things that you think, I didn't know I could do that, I would love to be where you are, or at least, you know, like have some advice about how I can do something similar to that. It makes a big difference compared to if you see a goal and then, you know, like no one else like you is aspiring towards that or is in that sector, and you sort of think like, is this really for me? Am I allowed over there in that, you know, distant future with all of those men doing all of that stuff, or should I just stay over here and be quiet? So I think lists like this are really important for that, because then you can see, you know, like these 20 women who are doing amazing things in the software sector, and the hope is that other people can, you know, like looking to go into software development or looking to make a shift in their career can be like, oh, wow, well, if those people are doing it, maybe I can do it too. So my call to action, well, the Maker's call to action is that the nominations for these lists, the Power List and the Change Makers List, are open until the 2nd of May 2022. So if you have anyone to put forward, that would be great. Put them up for it.
And we'll make it very clear how you can do that from the article that goes with the podcast. We're recording on the 22nd of April, so that's, and the podcast should drop sometime next week.
Mm-hmm. So you should have a bit of time to put some awesome women forward if you so feel it is fit. And the Changemakers List is about teams, people, organisations that are advancing diversity and inclusion in the software sector as well. So that's another category that you can put nominations forward for. And then we'll find out who wins in June. What do you guys think about role models?
That's interesting, because I actually was having a think about role models vis-a-vis this and a couple of other things that you'd written, Claire, about the Every Woman event, because I was quite to the fore there. I don't know, because so I can think of maybe four journalists, who one of whom I know, who I regard as a bit of a role model, and that's been kind of useful for me, but I wouldn't say very. But yeah, that's so. I was trying to think quite hard if I had any, and that's the best I could do.
Are these male tech journalists?
One of them is kind of a male tech journalist.
So a role model towards what path? And are the, like, so on the path that you're seeing these role models for yourself, are you one of the predominant people in those roles and sector? So could anybody potentially be a role model for you because everybody else in the sector is also a white man?
Yeah, so that makes it less, I mean, it's less of a burning issue, isn't it, really, for blokes to have those kind of role models
in certain sectors, not in every
certain sectors. Yeah, right. Yeah, Yeah, no, I mean, to be honest, it was a real head scratcher for me because I was thinking, well, I can think of four journalists who I really admire, are kind of heroes in a way. And as I said, one of them I know, actually know slightly as well in real life. And that's kind of, I suppose it's kind of handy because you think, well, you know, what do I want to be like in my craft? So for me, it's more about craft. It's, you know, what would they do? What would they think in a certain situation presented with a certain sort of story?
I was just going to mention that I've been to a few open source conferences.
Yeah.
And there generally is always a, for want of a better word, a high profile female software developer presenting to a predominantly male audience to showcase. And this is things like, this is all the stuff that is on GitHub or, you know, from whatever, or, you know, and I think because the open source community is associated with male developers, it's really good that they're putting forward techie women to showcase that there are, you know, it's a very diverse community and anyone can, and there is actually a very low point of entry. You don't need to be super technical to participate in the open source community, yet it does seem like it's a bit alien to most people.
Is there a level of anonymity in the open source community? So do you have to disclose who you are, what your role is, what gender you are?
Oh, that's a really good point.
I haven't looked into that. I do know that the organisers of these events really do try hard to promote diversity. And maybe it's because there's a sense that it is dominated by, I won't say, you know, a majority would be male, but it is ethnically diverse as it is at the moment. It's definitely ethnically diverse and it's worldwide. I think it is, unless you work for an organization that is big in open source, one of the big software firms, Facebook, Google, as a female programmer, it's unlikely that you will be engaged in the open source.
I wonder if that's because you self-select out of it. I don't know if I would have the confidence to be like, here's some work I've done, it's awesome, in front of a group of other developers, if that makes sense.
I think you need support from your organization, whoever you're working. I mean, it's the same with anyone working in software development. To put something in the open source community is a bit like, for us, when we write an article and post it somewhere, I can't think of anywhere public, I mean it wouldn't be LinkedIn, it would be somewhere else where everyone around the world is looking at it. Computerweekly.com obviously. But somewhere where it is open to a high level of criticism. A bit like peer review. I mean we don't exactly have that in journalism, but imagine that is what I imagine.
No, we don't.
I think that's what open source is a bit like, and it can be seen as not as constructive criticism because of the way that people put forward the recommend, you know, how they try to improve what you've done. And unfortunately, that's the case. It can be seen as quite aggressive, I imagine. I would not feel confident myself in putting up anything into the open source world. I don't know. It's a step too far. But, you know, I'm sure that there are places that what we can contribute.
Interesting things to think on.
Definitely. So, as I said near the start of this episode this week, I went to visit a CIO. And as it happens, it was a CIO who has a very strong personal interest in the metaverse, blockchain, non-fungible tokens, NFTs, and machine learning too. So some of the things that we were talking about at the beginning, nothing really, or very little, I think, to do with his actual job, but just a personal set of interests. And I'll come back to that in a sec. He's had also, he's had a long career in corporate IT, working for multinational companies. So very much in situations where, you know, you need to be aware of the diversity of different national cultures. So like you can't talk to an Italian the same way you would talk to a German, things like that. So a lot of experience of that kind of different communication styles. And this is, to get to his name, Yanis Levantis, who's group CIO of Unipart. He's Greek, his name would suggest. He's been in the UK a long time, though. Got a couple of master's degrees, one in mechanical engineering, one in finance. So, you know, both kind of sides of what you would need as a business IT professional. Very strong background in SAP, on the receiving end of SAP as a customer, as I said, Unilever, which he joined as a kind of, you know, trainee, and got an excellent training and education, he was telling me, GSK and Rolls-Royce as well. He's been in the role that he's in now, Unipart, for just over a year. Now, to me, Unipart is a big local employer. So my squash coach worked for Unipart, I think as a skilled worker, because they make stuff. You know, they make, originally they made like parts. They come out of the car industry fundamentally. Oxford has a long tradition in the car industry, beginning with Morris Minors and things like that. And there's the BMW plant now, which makes the Mini Cooper. And around the factory, around the plant, there's all sorts of little businesses that have grown up over the years. And Unipart comes out of that, British Leyland, in fact, is where it came from. And they've got this kind of heritage at Unipart, which is summed up in the slogan, the Unipart way. It's very consciously modelled on the Toyota way, you know, total quality management, lean manufacturing, elimination of waste, big emphasis on quality. I know Cliff's written quite a lot about that kind of thing in the past, lean and whatnot in terms of software development. So that's their kind of heritage. So he's kind of building on that a bit. But in terms of recent news, so they've chosen the RISE with SAP service. They became an SAP customer at the beginning of the 2000s. And what the trick about this is that they have, you know, their own internal IT function, but they also have a kind of systems integration IT services business that comes out of their logistics expertise. And that's one of the reasons why they've gone with this RISE with SAP service, because it enables them, or it will enable them, to do those implementations like for other customers, for their customers. I think I've spoken about RISE before on the podcast, but in any case, a reminder won't go amiss. So RISE is cloud-based, and it basically delivers SAP's S4 ERP system, which replaces an earlier ERP system called ECC6. Cliff's written a lot about ECC6 and moving to S4 or not. And S4 is based on this, I suppose what SAP would argue is a really cool database, HANA. It's in memory, it's columnar, it's fast, and so on. But basically RISE, to boil it down,
just one thing, Brian. S4, the HANA database, is specifically not Oracle, which is what ECC needed.
strategically, the creation of the HANA database was all about shifting away from the Oracle database. Absolutely. Hassel Plattner, who's him and his, you know, acolytes, designed HANA, and then they built the ERP system, or they've been gradually building the ERP system on top of that, and now delivering it over the cloud. And this is a way of doing that, because what a RISE contract does is it puts together the management of the cloud infrastructure with managed services, but into one contract. So if you become a RISE customer, you tick a box, essentially. You either have AWS as your cloud provider, or Microsoft Azure, or Google Cloud Platform. So all the things that, you know, Caroline talks about on the podcast, you choose one of those, and then you don't have to worry about it as a customer. SAP takes care of that, for you. So they've chosen AWS, and there's a long explanation as to why he did that. And I'll be writing a proper full CIO profile based on my long conversation with Yanis Levantis, which I've not written yet, but, you know, we'll do fairly soon, and you know, there'll be some context about some of the reasons why AWS, which is actually quite interesting, but I don't have time to go into it here. I suppose the key thing here is that Unipart is adopting it both for its internal IT function and for its IT services business that it's externalizing, which, you know, is quite an interesting phenomenon, that whole thing of the blurring of like a customer of SAP becoming a sort of a reseller, but it's much more sophisticated than that, because it's based on an established, in their case, it's an established logistics business, which has a lot of IT connected with it, not just SAP tech, but other tech as well. But basically, I enjoyed meeting Yanis very much. It was a quick 10-minute drive from where I live to the site. But there are a couple of things that he said that I'm really keen to get feedback from you guys on. So we'll see whether this resonates with you or not. So one thing that Yanis said was, this is just his opinion, right? I mean, he might be wrong, but his opinion is that he thinks there's a whole generation of senior IT professionals who, because they want to cozy up so much to the business and not talk about technology, not put the business people off, that actually they've taken their eye off the technology ball and they've become less expert in the tech. One of the things that he said is, if you don't really have an absolute passion for technology, then maybe, you know, you should be considering something else. That, you know, you can't lose that. As a senior IT professional, you can't lose that interest in the actual tech.
I only have one very small point to make about this. I think you could argue that the higher you get in an organization, the more you are about people management. And yeah, you do have to have an understanding of new technologies, current technologies, what they do, what they're for. But you also will be in charge of people that will have an opinion and know those things. So it's more about people management than technology management. That's my take.
I agree with that. And I spoke to the CEO, the new CEO of Nutanix, who was one of the guys who invented some very clever networking stuff in the 90s, and he's got a PhD in networking, and he worked at IBM Research in Zurich, and a whole load of, you know, really interesting career moves before he ended up at Cisco and was given an opportunity to become a product manager. And I said to him, well, and then he became general manager of this particular division. I said, well, you know, how do you then deal with the techies who are pitching you stuff, and when you have all of this know-how behind you? And he said, well, they're smarter than me, you know. So you go through this career where you're a real techie, you become the head of the business or the head of the sort of technical side, if you're a CIO. And then there are always going to be people who are smarter than you, who you then have to hire the right smart people and develop the right smart people so that you don't have to be hands-on anymore.
Yeah, I mean, that does make a lot of sense. And what you said makes a lot of sense to me too.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, you'll still be accountable for the decisions that you make based on the opinion of, you know, like the people that you're in charge of. So you do have to have, you know, like a certain amount of knowledge and a team of people that you've developed yourself and that you trust. Because if it all goes wrong, it was your choice because you're the manager. But at the end of the day, yeah, I mean...
Yeah, sorry, there is one thing I would like to add is... I think there's a risk that a CIO who becomes very, very, very aligned to the business forgets about his team or her team. They only think about the business, and they only think about one aspect of the business because they're not paid to be business people 100%. They're paid to be the business IT person. And that means managing and making sure your team is the best at delivering the technology services for the business.
I think that's what, what he's saying. He's saying that, I've not heard anyone say exactly what he said before, that there is, he has observed a generation of very senior IT professionals who have almost lost interest in technology in a way. So he's not arguing that the people skills, etc., and knowing about the business side of things, the business side of the business, the financial side of the business and things like that, he's not saying that's unimportant. He's saying you have to do that really, really well too, but you can't lose sight of, you know, what makes you kind of specific and special, which is that you have kind of domain expertise in the tech. See, where this becomes, he might not be right about this, but where this becomes, I think, compelling and interesting is when you come to negotiate with the suppliers. Because Cliff, you were talking about really a supplier there. So if you're facing up to these technology companies who have tons and tons and tons of expertise and lots of lawyers behind them, they really know what they're doing. If your game has dropped over maybe a 4 to 5 year period, I'm not going to say you're going to get taken for a ride, but you will be at a bit of a disadvantage. Mm. And the other thing that he said was you really need to understand contract law, you know, at his kind of level, because if you're dealing in contracts that are, you know, 50 million quid plus, you know, you can't be affording to make mistakes.
No, not when you're dealing with SAP. I mean, if you look at what he's trying to do, for just from what you said, and what Diageo was trying to do. I mean, basically,
yeah, you do.
Up a supply chain, you know, connecting. You need to do it in a way that the contract allows you to do so. And I think that's Diageo learned to their expense that if you don't, you can't cut corners with your contracts.
And the technology has got more complex, and it's got more complex partly because of cloud delivery. And then this whole new generation of tech that's about machine learning, and it's not as simple as it was 10 to 15 years ago. So if in the meantime you've been climbing the corporate ladder and learning about all, you know, to really cozy up to the business and understand business stuff. And to be fair to Yanis also, I should make the point that he hates, like a lot of CIOs, he hates that language of the business, you know, because IT in an organization like that, in a customer organization, is part of the business. It's not a separate thing to the business. So I think essentially what you're saying is the pendulum has swung maybe a little bit too far, because if you think back to maybe the year 2000, IT people were much more, I don't care about what your business is. I'll build stuff for you. You pay me the money. I'll code on my own with my headphones on and wearing my hoodie. And I don't want to engage with anyone else. So that was how things were a bit in the early 2000s. And then, but there was a swing right away from that towards being much more business friendly, much more aware that you're a corporate citizen within a company. You're not just somebody who's paid for their IT smarts. But that's gone so far now that some of the really super senior people, kind of CIO level, CTO level, you know, are kind of, in his view, you know, the dream game has dropped a little bit. And then that makes them vulnerable to the sharks in the IT industry. He'll very happily take your money. I will, as I said, be writing that up, and we'll link to that interview from the article that goes with the podcast. And you can, you know, get to all the stories that we've discussed in this episode through that article as well, and listen to the podcast itself on computerweekly.com. And you can subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Amazon Music. Sadly, I think we've covered a lot of ground today, guys. I think that's all we've got time for this time around. Just remains for me to say thank you so much, Cliff, for coming back on the podcast.
Thank you.
And thank you so much to Claire.
Anytime.
And thank you to you, listener, very much for listening to us and getting all the way to the end. And I will say goodbye. Till next time. Bye-bye.
Bye.